The hero of the story, John 1:1-5, was presented by Jack Crabtree on December 15, 2002, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2002. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
This message got away from me a little bit. I had intended to work on a message for Christmas. So I decided, among other options, to go to the first chapter of John to talk about Jesus and Jesus coming into the world. But I was thinking more in the direction of Hallmark for this morning, but it's not going to work that way, I'm afraid. What happened is I was looking at John 1 fresh, just having spent several weeks now, or months, looking at 1 John. And I began to see some things in the first chapter of John differently in view of the conclusions that I had come to in 1 John, because it's the same author writing about the same things and using the same kind of vocabulary. And that's made a difference in the way that I look at the first chapter of John. So what I want to do this morning is look afresh at particularly the first 5 verses of the Gospel of John. And I want to make a bold proposal about what John means here. Some of you have heard me talk about the first part of John in the past, and I'm tweaking my understanding a little bit. It's not a significant shift, but it's a different way of looking at it. So I want to look at the interpretation of the first 5 verses, and then I'll give my Christmas message. Then we'll talk a little bit about who Jesus is. What you have in this handout is my most current translation on one side. And by the way, this is formatted in much the same way that my translation of 1 John will be, that I'm going to make available to you in a couple weeks. The reason I'm going to teach from my own translation has not so much to do with the translation, because I can always talk about how to alter the translation, but it has to do with the formatting. And if you'll notice on this formatting of the Gospel of John here, I've divided it into just simply paragraphs that I think logically divide the argument or the rhetoric of the section. So that you are encouraged by the formatting to group together ideas that I think were intended to be grouped together and to separate ideas that I think were intended to be separate. That's the one thing that our translations don't really do. And they end up, by virtue of that fact, they end up misleading us. So the reason I want to work from my own translation is so I can refer to paragraph 1, paragraph 2, paragraph 3, section 1, section 2, instead of chapter and verse. And if you're using the traditional chapter verse, you'll be a little lost. So I would encourage you to work with me from that translation if at all possible. So anyway, there's the format that it will be in. On the second page, I have what I consider a more traditional interpretation of John 1:1-5. And I've listed some problems with that interpretation, and I want to go over those here in a second. And then the most recent interpretation of John 1:1-5 that I have held, and some problems that I see with that interpretation. And I'm going to go over that by way of defending this new interpretation that I'm offering you this morning. So let's start by looking at the traditional interpretation on the back, the traditional interpretation of John 1:1-5. I've largely taken the New American Standard and then just made some additional additions here to clarify what I think the traditional interpretation is. John 1:1, in the beginning was the Word, and by that, traditionally, that's come to be the second person of the triune Godhead. So in the beginning was the Word, the Greek word is logos, the second person of the triune Godhead, and the Word, second person of the triune Godhead, was with God, and the Word was God. Second verse, He, the second person of the triune Godhead, was in the beginning with God. Third verse, all things came into being through Him, second person of the triune Godhead, and apart from Him, that second person of the Trinity, nothing came into being that has come into being. Fourth verse, in Him, second person of the Trinity, was life, and the life was the light of men. In verse 5, the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not comprehend it. Okay, I see there are a number of problems with this way of looking at John 1, 1 through 5, I think. The first one that I have listed here is that it's virtually impossible to understand these verses here as a unified and coherent thought. It just ends up being a patchwork of unconnected thoughts without any clue as to why we're being told what we're being told. I mean, just stop to think about this for a second. John sets out to write this letter, and he says, well, in the beginning, there was the second person of the Trinity. Never mind that I've never told you that there was the first and third person of the Trinity, but in the beginning was the second person of the Trinity. And I want you to know that He was with God. In fact, He was God. Now, typically, the reason we interpret that is because we want a proof text to defend the Trinity. And we look at that and go, there it is. There's my proof text for defending the Trinity, because He mentions the second person of the Trinity right here, and you can't have a second person of the Trinity without having a first and third person of the Trinity. So there's my proof text. So we see the way it is functioning as simply a theological piece of evidence, a piece of theological and doctrinal evidence. No other reason. Why would John start off his gospel by giving us that piece of theological evidence? I don't know. We don't even ask the question, though, I think. We don't even ask why you would start the gospel that way. We just take it for granted that that's why it's there. That's what it's doing. What does he do in the second verse? He was in the beginning with God. He just repeats himself. That repetition has always been troubling to me. I'm going to talk about that a little bit further. But never mind. He's just repeating himself, so we're still dealing with the Trinity. Okay, next point. All things came into being through Him, and apart from Him, nothing came into being that has come into being. Okay, why are we now all of a sudden concerned that we make sure that we get our persons of the Trinity straight? The second point he wants to make is, let's be really, really clear. It wasn't the first person of the Trinity who created everything. It wasn't the third person of the Trinity who created everything. It was the second person of the Trinity who was the agent in God's creation to get everything created that was created. Why is he telling us all this? What does this have to do with the gospel that follows? I don't know. We never even asked that question, I think. Next verse. In Him, the second person of the Trinity, was life. What does that mean? Not sure. But whatever else is true, we know in our doctrine that we identify life with the second person of the Trinity, supposedly as distinct from the other members. And the life was the light of men. What does that mean? Don't know. Probably what we mean by that is the light of man is just one more title for the second person of the Trinity. And we just want to make sure that we get our titles right. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not comprehend it. Probably it's translated that way because we have in mind later in the Gospel of John where it talks about Jesus coming into the world and not being received by them. They didn't get it. They didn't understand Him. Does that follow in any way from verses 1 through 4? Well, not really. My point being, this is treated as if it's just a series, a list of basically unrelated, basically unconnected pieces of theological data. It's not literature. It's not an argument. It's not even really a preface. It's not even really a prologue. It's just this deposit of theological ore that we can mine for doctrinal evidence, and that's how we're looking at it. That doesn't seem likely to me. The prologue to John's gospel seems more likely to be something that's going to read as a prologue to his gospel. And we haven't understood it unless it reads like a prologue. So that's my first problem, is I don't even know how to read it as a prologue if we interpret it this way. And especially I have as verse 2, the connection between verses 1 through 3 and verses 4 and 5 is particularly problematic. It's difficult to know what the connection is supposed to be. On this reading, the most straightforward reading of verse 3, I'm on my third point now, is a problematic assertion. Was the second person of the Godhead really the primary agent of creation? Or if the assertion itself is not problematic, its relevance is problematic. So what if everything was created by the second person of the Trinity in particular? I mean, when we read the Genesis account, which is the basic, fundamental, essential, primary statement of creation, the Spirit who inspired the Scripture is not at all concerned to make sure that we know the relative roles of all the members of the Trinity in the creation of the world. The basic fundamental doctrine of creation is simply the fact that this is a created world created by a transcendent creator. Why is John all of a sudden wanting to give us some special, particular, unique little insight into the creation that we make sure that that Jesus himself was the creator, the agent of creation, and not God the Father? Now, the traditional theological views in systematic theology, of course, is that God is the original creator, the original source of creation, and Jesus was simply a kind of mediator, tool, agent of creation. I mean, as a child, the only way I could visualize that is that God was the hammer and Jesus was the anvil. As he fashioned the creation, Jesus served as the anvil for God to use in fashioning his creation. Where, if it weren't for this traditional interpretation of the first chapter of John, where on earth would we ever get that idea anywhere else in the Bible? So do we really seriously think that the whole point of the prologue to John's gospel is, let me let you in on a little mysterious secret about the creation? It wasn't just a simple matter of God saying, let there be light, and there was light. It wasn't quite that simple. You see, God had to mediate the power, his creative power, through an agent who is the second person of the Trinity, who is also the one through whom everything was created. Is that what John is saying? I know that's what Orthodox traditional theology says, but is that what John is saying here in John 1? And if not, where? Where is that taught? So that's a problem. We don't really have any other support outside of this prologue to see that as an obviously true or in any way relevant doctrinal fact. Likewise, on this reading, the content and relevance of the assertion made by verse 4 is problematic. In him, the second person of the Trinity, was life, and the life was the light of men. Is life to be found in the second person of the Trinity in particular? And if so, why would that be important? I mean, in both of these cases, with the second person of the Trinity being life, and the second person of the Trinity being the Creator, John does absolutely nothing anywhere else in the Gospel with those facts. He doesn't do anything to show us why that should be relevant, that it is in particular the second person of the Trinity. So why does he introduce it if it never becomes important to anything he has to say later? Finally, my contention would be that if tradition and orthodoxy had not dictated it to us, one would not be likely to interpret logos here. Logos is the one translated word in this passage. We would not be likely to interpret logos here as the second person of the Godhead. If I hadn't been taught from my earliest days in Sunday school that that's how I was supposed to read it, and if I were, as somebody coming out of a pagan background reading the Bible for the first time, if I were to read the Gospel of John, no way in the world would I go, oh, the Word, oh yeah, the second person of the Trinity, of course. Nothing would suggest that to me, I would argue. Okay, so not that long ago, in recent years then, I've rethought that and had come up with an alternative interpretation that reads like the bottom half of that page, the other alternative that I have proposed before. That would read something like this. In the beginning was the Logos, and it's hard to translate, but let me just for now say the ultimate mind. And the background to this is, my studies in Gutenberg has helped reinforce this. As you go back to read the pre-Socratic philosophers, and then you read Plato, and then you come and read the Stoics, there's this long-standing tradition in the ancient Greek world to identify this cosmos that we live in, this created order that we live in. They recognized that this created order was the product of a rational mind. That was clear to them, crystal clear to the Greeks. Not a single one of them challenges that. This is the product of a rational mind. Well, what is that rational mind that gave rise to the rationality of this product that is the universe we live in? Well, they had two names that they used for it. One, the earliest writers tended to call it nous in Greek, which just means the word for mind. But they also called it, and the term that came to prevail in Greek culture was logos. Now, we have been so enculturated to think that logos means word, strictly speaking, that this is not transparent to us. But the Greek word logos, yes, it can mean word, but only in the sense that logos is that which the human mind and human understanding conceives that it will give utterance to in a word. I mean, there's two ways to talk about a word. A word is a sound that I make, but a word is also a concept that I am trying to convey to you through this sound that I'm making. Depending upon which direction you look at the word word, you can either talk about it being an utterance, a sound, or you can talk about it being a product of the human mind, a conception that I'm seeking to convey to you through language. Logos comes from that direction. It's this product of a human mind, a human rationality that is seeking to be conveyed through words. Go look at the entry in the classical Greek lexicon, Liddell and Scott. You've got about 3 pages on logos. I'm probably exaggerating, but it's a really, really big entry. And logos means all kinds of different things. But all of the meanings meet in the idea that logos has to do with rational understanding, rationality itself. That's the fundamental underlying logic behind the word. We get the word logic, by the way, from logos. So, with that in the background, he's using the Greek language. There's this vast, ubiquitous Greek culture affecting the whole ancient world at the time that John is writing this. So, my proposal was, in the beginning was the logos, that is, the one that everyone acknowledges is the mind behind the origin of all of reality. In the beginning was this logos, the ultimate mind, and this logos was present with God. Indeed, God was this logos, this ultimate mind. This logos, or ultimate mind, was in the beginning with God. Notice again the repetition. He just repeats himself. All things came to be through this logos, that is, in accord with his purposes, the rational purposes produced by this rational mind. Indeed, nothing that has ever come to be has come to be apart from it, that rationality and the purposes of that rationality. In this logos, that is, in his purposes, was life in the final age, and in fact, this life was the light, the ultimate good of mankind. Now this very light, the possibility of light, yet shines in the midst of the darkness of human ignorance. The darkness has not extinguished it. Now I don't want to exposit this whole thing because I don't have time for that, but notice that at least, as I'm reading this now, at least this can serve as a prologue to the gospel. Because what is he saying? This is a rationally ordered reality that was rationally ordered by the ultimate rational orderer, namely the Logos, who we know is God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And included in what was purposed by this rational order of all reality was this thing called life. And this thing called life, and what by that he means, as we will see in 1 John, whenever he uses the word life, he means life in some final age, life beyond life here and now, ultimate life that's going to be everlasting in a whole new heavens and earth, a whole new kingdom, a whole new age. That was God's agenda from the get-go, was this life. And he says it was the light of men. Not knowing what else to do with that, I borrowed a page out of Plato where light can be a metaphor for the ultimate good. And I suggested maybe he's saying life was established for us as the ultimate good for mankind. I think that's true, and that's one way to understand this. Okay, then this really poignant comment that I think serves as the prelude to the gospel. This light, which means the possibility of this ultimate good for mankind, this life, continues, is yet now shining in the darkness of human ignorance. The darkness has not extinguished it. The word that they translated comprehend in verse 5 in the traditional interpretation is the word that's used when you talk about extinguishing a candle. It's also used in certain contexts for comprehend. I'm not sure I remember the logic behind that, but it's more standard, typical uses to extinguish something. And that word is used when somebody is extinguishing a candle. That's the verb they would use. That makes more sense here. The light is shining in the darkness. The darkness did not extinguish it. Well, that's a very poignant prologue to his gospel, because the whole gospel story that he's going to tell is the story of how the light came into the world and indeed has ultimately triumphed in the world. The truth is there to be known because Jesus entered into human history, made that truth known, and the truth has persisted and has prevailed against all the lies, all the deceptions, all the foolishness, all the ignorance of humankind that would want to reject it and would want to destroy it. It has prevailed nonetheless. And that's the good news that John wants to tell, is the good news of that light coming into the world in order that we might know the way to life. Well, that's not a disconnected, fragmented set of theological data any longer. That's actually a literary prologue that actually introduces the gospel. So that has commended itself to me for several years now. Yet there are problems with that interpretation, and let's look at those. On this reading, this one that I have held, the primary point of what I call paragraph one is the equation of God with the Logos, God being the ultimate mind who's the rational orderer of all of reality, on this reading. The fact that the Logos was with God is sort of a throwaway point. I mean, the way I've read it was, in the beginning was the Logos. The Logos was with God. Oh, never mind. He actually was God. Yes, he was with him, but, you know, that's sort of trivial in view of the fact that, well, actually, he was God himself, so of course he was with him because he was God himself. So the fact that he was with God becomes a really sort of understatement that gets bypassed and trumped by the equation of the Logos with God. But according to the text, and this is something that bothers me about this interpretation, according to the actual text, what John emphasizes is the fact that the Logos is with God, because he repeats it. He says it twice. In the beginning was the Logos. The Logos was with God. In fact, God was the Logos. In the beginning, the Logos was with God. So that's the one. That's the point he emphasizes, not the identity. So, but my new proposal solves this problem, and we'll look at it here in a second. My new proposal solves this problem. We'll come back to that. Second problem with this interpretation. This reading interprets light in paragraph 2 in a way that is consistent with ancient Greek usage, namely, I got it from Plato. But And this is where my study of 1 John has affected me. But it is not consistent with how John always seems to use it. John does not use light for what is the ultimate good. He uses light as a metaphor for enlightenment. The bringing of knowledge, the bringing of wisdom, the bringing of understanding, the disclosing of mysteries and secrets that have not been known before is the light shining in the darkness. Well, when we get to 1 John, we'll see that that's how he's using it. It seems likely, in view of the parallels between what he's saying here and what he's saying in 1 John, that he's using light the same way. Third problem. On this reading, light in paragraph 3 does not correspond exactly with how it is being interpreted in paragraph 2. If light is the ultimate good of mankind, then all of a sudden he switches abruptly to clearly use light as a form of enlightenment. The light is shining in the darkness, and the darkness did not extinguish it. I'm forced there to say, well, he's just using light in two statements next to each other in a different way, in a kind of abruptly different way. It's not impossible, but it's a problem. And then finally, while logos is taken to have the same basic meaning throughout in this reading that we're discussing, I can make sense of the text only by proposing that it denotes two distinctly different things. Sometimes a personal rational being, in paragraph 1, other times the rational purposes purposed by that being, in paragraph 2. My new proposal is going to solve this in a slightly different way. So, what is my new proposal? Let's look at the other side of the sheet, the part in the box. I'm going to translate logos in two different ways here. I think he's using logos. He's being equivocal in the way he uses logos. He uses it one way to make his primary point, but he uses it in a different way to make a secondary point. Now, logos is a very, very variable term, so that's a plausible thing to do. And furthermore, in my other reading, even though I was trying to maintain consistency in taking logos to be this rational personal being who is the ultimate mind behind all reality, I couldn't help but adjust what it meant in paragraph 2. And really basically mean those rational purposes that were the product of that rational mind. Okay? Well, I solved the problem this way by recognizing that there's another way that logos gets used. There's a whole big entry in it in Liddell and Scott. Logos can be a story, a narrative, a tale that someone tells. And it strikes me this time that that's what John is trying to say. I've translated script maybe a tad bit tendentiously, but so if you don't like script, we can go with story. But logos can be the story or the tale that someone is telling. So it reads like this. In the beginning was the script, and this script was present with God. Indeed, God was the logos. That is the ultimate mind who conceived it. So another way of translating this would be, in the beginning was the logos with a small l, and this logos with a small l was present with God. Indeed, God was the logos with a large l, and understood to mean, in the beginning was the little l logos, and this little logos was present with God. Indeed, God was the logos with a capital L by whom the logos was conceived. That makes some sense to me. So in the beginning was the script, and the script was present with God. Indeed, God was the logos, the ultimate mind who conceived it. This script was in the beginning with God. All things came to be in line with it. Indeed, nothing that has ever come to be has come to be apart from it. In this script was life in a final age, and the way to this life was the substance of the light of true knowledge for mankind. Now this very light yet shines in the midst of the darkness of human ignorance. The darkness has not extinguished it. So the other adjustment I'm making here is the way I'm understanding the light. When he says this life was the light of men, you know, Jesus says he is the life at one point. What does he mean by that? He means he's the source of life. John, it's characteristic of John's style to speak metaphorically, where you just name something and what you mean is it is the way to that, or the source to that, or the means to that, or whatever. When Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life, when he says he's the truth, he doesn't mean literally that he is to be equated with the truth. What he means, he is the way to truth, the source of truth, the one who reveals truth. Likewise, I don't think John means literally here that life was the light of men, that it was literally the light of men. What he means is the way to life was the light of men in the sense of it was that knowledge, light, that mankind needs. That light, that knowledge that is essential to making a human being enlightened, knowledgeable, wise with that with which we need to be wise. In other words, what is it that we desperately need to know as human beings? The way to life, with a capital L, what we call eternal life. If we know that, we know everything we need to know. If we don't know that, no matter how much we know nothing. And I think that's his way of saying, this is the crucial piece of information that is the key to human existence, knowing the way to life, knowing life. Okay, so let's finish this section then. There came a man sent by God. His name was John. That man, John, came to serve as a witness to testify with regard to the light, so that all might believe through him who was the light. This man, John, was not the light. Rather, he came to testify regarding the light. There was the true light, that which enlightens every man when it comes into the world. He was in the world. Now the world came into being for him, not through him, for him. I think that is translated badly on three or four different occasions in the New Testament. He uses the same language. Both Paul and John, everyone who says this, uses exactly the same language. And I think the point they're making is the world was created for Jesus. The world was created as the stage for the major player of cosmic history to play upon. Jesus is the protagonist. Jesus is the hero. Jesus is the whole point. And we are, if we can dig it, props. We are supporting actors and actresses in order to portray the drama that is about Jesus. It was all for him. The world came into being for him, but the world did not know him. He came to his own, but those who were his own did not accept him. But as many as did accept him, God gave them the right to be children of God, notably those who believe in his name. They are children of God not by virtue of blood, and not by virtue of the will of the flesh, and not by virtue of the will of man. Rather, they have been fathered by God. So then, the Logos, and now he's using it with a capital L, the ultimate mind. So then the Logos became human flesh and resided among us, and we saw his glory, glory as of the unique one sent from the Father. He was full of grace and truth. John has testified regarding him and has cried out, saying, this was he of whom I was speaking. One coming after me has been made to be before me, for he was prior to me. Accordingly, we have all received from his fullness, even grace to replace the former grace. Because the covenant was given through Moses, grace and truth came to be through Jesus, the Messiah. No one has seen God at any time. The unique Son, he who is at the breast of the Father, he has explained him. Okay, now to Christmas. I want to look at this passage, and as I have read it here, as I have interpreted it here, to try to highlight who it is that this Jesus is who came into the world on Christmas Day thousands of years ago. The first thing to notice is that if I'm right in reading John here, life, our life, all of human history is a story. And Jesus is the hero of that story. So to really grasp the significance of Christmas, yet I haven't seen it, I've only read the book, but not too many days from now, the second part of Lord of the Rings is coming out. Notice the way Tolkien treats Aragorn in Lord of the Rings. He's been promised to the city of... Help me. Minas Tirith. Okay. He's been promised. They've been waiting for him for years and years and years, the return of the rightful king. They've been waiting for him. And the way Tolkien portrays it is... And I don't remember the details, but in the end, he is a loved person by these people. Why is he a loved person? He's a loved person because he's the promise of everything that they've been hoping in. He's the main plot. He's the main character. He's the main man. At least in this little subplot of this city of Minas Tirith, he's the main man. That's what we are to understand at Christmas time. Why is this baby being born in Bethlehem a big deal? Because he's the main man, finally, after millennia of waiting for him, millennia of hoping and suffering and agonizing over the meaningless suffering of human existence as we're all on hold waiting for the hero to finally arrive, to finally come on the scene. What all the angels declared and what all those early people, Joseph, Mary, Anna, Simeon, all those people, what all of them recognized is, this is it. This is the hero coming onto the scene. For so much of my Christian life, I have not been able to relate to that. Because, you know, yet... I suppose partly our sinfulness plays in here, my sinfulness plays in here, but you don't want anybody else to be the big deal. Why can't I be the big deal? Why can't I be the hero? Why can't I be the main man? There's an incredible kind of humility that we have to come to be able to bow the knee to Jesus, to be able to come to the point and say, oh, I see, the universe wasn't created for me. The universe was created for Jesus. And to be okay with that is an incredible act of humility on our part. To accept our role as a supporting actor or a supporting actress, to accept our role as a prop even, if you will, and to say, but that's okay, because this is a great story that God is telling, and I'm glad to be a part of it at all. That's the humility we need to come to, but it is not easy. I think the other thing that I have missed is the fact that Christianity is a story, that that truth is a story. For much of my Christian experience, I have told myself that Christianity is a philosophy of life. That's what it is. Like Buddhism is a philosophy of life. Like Hinduism is a philosophy of life. Like Islam is a philosophy of life. I think that's true of any other religion and any other philosophy in the world, is that they are, when all is said and done, simply philosophies of life. And what do I mean by that? What they have to offer is simply some rather forceful suggestions about how you need to conduct yourself in this existence in order to make it go better rather than worse. If you really want the most out of your existence, you ought to live this way. This is how you ought to live. And I have always conceived of my Christian faith as another philosophy of life. If I want to get the most out of my existence, I need to live this way rather than some other way. I need to walk by faith. I need to believe in Jesus. I need to walk by the Spirit. I need to gain victory over sin by being hip to how reality works and doing it right. And on and on and on and on. Now, is Christianity a philosophy of life? Well, yeah, It does involve that. It does include that. It does imply a certain philosophy of life, but it's more than that. And it explains why, when all is said and done, the gospel is called the gospel rather than, you know, the Jesus philosophy of life or something. Why is it called the gospel? Because it's the telling of a story, a really good story, a story that has a really happy ending for those who embrace the story, for those who acknowledge the story. It's the what modern philosophers call the narrative structure of reality that I think had been lost on me for years. But if I'm right, that's exactly what John is pointing to. Reality has a narrative structure. It's a story being told. And the truth is the fact that this story is the real story that's really being told and not a bunch of lies. It's the real story that's really going down. And the gospel is the good news about what that story entails. One of the implications of that, well, there's two levels at which this story is taking place. There's the story at a cosmic level, and I've already suggested that the main man and the hero of that story is Jesus. The question is there any way that you and I, who are mere pawns, mere props, is there any heroism for us? Can we be heroes in this story? And I think the answer to that is yes, absolutely. Some people, a rare few, a Martin Luther, an Apostle Paul, a John Calvin, a rare few are going to be minor figures in the story of history itself, in the story of human history. God used them to tell a story of cultural transformation, of political transformation, of theological transformation, of, in broad strokes, these just magnificent sweeping changes that happened in history focused on the activities and thought of a single individual. Well, most of us, indeed probably all of us, have no hope of ever playing that kind of role, and if we do, we don't get it by going after it, by being ambitious for it. It's a gift that is simply given at the discretion of God. But all of us are in a position to be heroic at another level, to be heroic in the story that's being told in our own interiors, in the interior drama of our own lives. No matter how hidden and obscure and invisible we might be to world history, we are fascinating people involved in a fascinating drama in the interior of our lives. The ultimate heroism is when, in my everyday, ordinary, mundane decisions, I champion what's right and defeat what is wrong within me. No one may ever know. No one may ever see the battle that was fought and won in me. All they ever see from me may be a very, very simple and humble act of love extended to them by some obscure, invisible person. That may be the only thing the world ever sees that ever becomes public. But that may have been the result of an incredible raging battle within my own soul, and goodness won. I'm going to be called upon at times to forgive people that everything within me is raging within me to not give them any forgiveness, to not show them any mercy because they hurt me or because they, you know, transgressed me in some way. And there may be a raging battle that goes on because I made the choice to credit integrity and goodness and righteousness and mercy over the other impulses that were raging within me. We play out these dramatic dramas every day of our lives. Hopefully we do. And to turn this into a philosophy of life, what do we need to do with that? How do we need to respond to that? We need to make sure that we line up on the right side and be a hero of the right things. Be a hero of that, of integrity, of humility, of truth, of justice, of righteousness, of wisdom, and so on. Not for other people's sake, not so that we can make a splash in the history of the world, but so that we can be the hero of a whole nother story, a story that I strongly suspect will be known one day, a story that will be archived in the archives of eternity and will be read and studied and examined and enjoyed and appreciated because we are the hero of that story. I mean, not because we are, but and we are the hero of that story. We'll be one more book in the Library of Heaven, one more novel in the Library of Heaven. So as a philosophy of life, the way we need to conduct ourselves is to make sure that we don't end up being a tragic character in this story that is going to be the story of our life, but that we end up truly being a heroic character in the story that is the story of our lives. Heroic because we embraced what is true. We embraced the God who is our Creator, sought to know Him and love Him, and sought to make my knowledge and love of God to dictate how I treated other people and how I thought about my own life, how I thought about my own struggles, and so on. So, if I'm right about what John is saying here, this is an incredibly important concept, the very narrative structure of life itself. The second thing that Jesus is that he, John says, is the true light. Jesus was the one who came into the world and enlightened mankind. The more I look at world history, the more this rings true. Something remarkable happened in human history at the advent of Christianity. And I think what it comes down to, just in a nutshell, I'll have to make this short, but just in a nutshell, I think what it comes down to is if you remember later in the Gospel of John, Jesus is talking to the disciples and he talks about what the Spirit of Truth, the Parakletos, who's going to come into the world. When the Spirit of Truth comes into the world, he's going to do a number of things, but one of the things he's going to do is convict the world of sin, righteousness, and judgment. I think there's a big difference that you see, that this is changing, that, you know, the waters are really murky right now in human history and culture, but, you know, back in my childhood, there were Hell's Angels. And Hell's Angels would go and fight and kill and get drunk and rape and pillage and do all kinds of stuff that has just been done throughout all of human history. I mean, they're not doing anything the Mongols didn't do. But the one thing that you'd find of a Hell's Angel is that he would call himself a Hell's Angel. What you'd find is a Hell's Angel would probably acknowledge to you, yeah, I'm going to hell. I'm destined for hell, and I'm defiant, and I'm resigned to that. I'm going to hell, but boy, am I going to give you hell on the way. And something to that effect. He understood sin, righteousness, and judgment. He simply had rejected all that. He simply had not taken that to its appropriate conclusions and was in defiance against what he knew was true. But he knew it was true, and he knew where he stood, and he was resigned to the fact that he stood condemned for who he was and what he did. But did that have any sort of civilizing, preservative effect at all? I think so. I think he's a different man from the Mongol hordes who did the same thing and patted themselves on the back and said, we are noble, virtuous, strong men. And my virtue and my strength is my vanquishing my enemy. I can kill who I want to kill, and I can rape who I want to rape, and I'm proud of it, and that is good. That's not civilized. And it seems to me that there was this sea change in human history and in the moral tenor of all of human history when Jesus came into the world and the Spirit of Truth following him enlightened the hearts of every man and woman and made us more open to the truth. made us more hip to it, made us more responsive to it, made us more sensitive to it in a way that hadn't been true in human history before then. I think Jesus was indeed the light that shined in the darkness, and we are the more enlightened because of it today. Now, if I'm reading my prophecy correctly, that's going to change, because the deceiver is going to be released again, who has been restricted, is going to be released again into the world to begin to deceive the world all over again. And I predict that we will become... No, I won't predict that. I predict that our civilization will be much more a facade and go less deep in the future. So Jesus is the light, the true light, John says. Jesus, thirdly, is the way that the unseeable God makes himself seen. That's the last verse there. No one has seen God at any time. The unique Son, he who is at the breast of the Father, he has explained him. That's a very, very important point, I think, because as we look at the God who's the author of all reality, he's the author of light, he's the author of darkness, he's the author of life, he's the author of death, he's the author of joy, he's the author of sorrow, he's the author of goodness, he's the author of evil. Who is he? What kind of dude is this guy who's the author of all reality? What am I supposed to do with him? Am I safe with him, or am I unsafe with him? Should I love him, or should I run from him? What do I do with God? It really is an open question if all we can know about him is how he runs this story that we're a part of. It becomes vitally important in the end that we have him explained to us, that someone come along and make clear to us that he is good and not evil. He is light and he is not darkness. In fact, as James puts it, that he's the father of lights in whom there isn't even the slightest deviation from being light. Not even a hint of a shadow of darkness in this God who's the author of all reality. How would we know that? We know that because Jesus has explained him. Jesus in what he did, Jesus in what he said, Jesus in what he was, represents to us the moral character of God in a way that we can understand. And what we understand when we look at Jesus is that God is love, God is merciful, God is gracious, yes, God is just, yes, God is pure, yes, God is righteous, but he is those things at the same time, that he's a merciful God who loves and does not hate, who's committed to goodness and cannot tolerate evil. We see that because we see God translated into a human being, and we can read human beings. We know the difference between a good human being and an evil human being, and Jesus was a good human being. If God is him, then now I know God. Lost count. Fourthly, fifthly, whatever it is, Jesus is the embodiment of the grace of God as well as the truth, as John puts it, the fullness of grace and truth. We know he's the fullness of the truth because he is the light, the true light. But John is going further to say he's the fullness of grace. It is in Jesus that is embodied the most magnificent, most spectacular act of God's grace extended toward us that God has ever extended, taking us when we were enemies and reconciling us to himself in order that he might bless us with life eternally. An incredible, incredible act of grace. And then finally, he's the unique Son, that is to say, the King. Jesus is the King who is going to rule over the eternal kingdom of God in the final age. He is Aragorn of Aragorns. He is the champion come into the world to claim his own. Okay, so at Christmas, what is it that we are celebrating? We're celebrating the birth of this person who is all these things that John just outlined here. And I think it is incumbent upon us to take all the sensual delights of Christmas, the smells, the sounds, the tastes, the artificial joy that we create for ourselves in the culture of Christmas. And by calling it that, I'm not denigrating it at all. Christmas is fun. Christmas is magical. But it's this artificial joy that we need to see through the artificial joy of the culture of Christmas to this incredible, substantial reality that lies behind it. Christmas was the most significant event in all of cosmic history. Let's just take 5 minutes for any comments or questions that you have.
I really love this at the last that you have, that no one has seen God at any time, the unique Son. He who is at the breast of the Father, he has explained him. I like that because it expresses a very emotionally okay kind of dad to be able to hold his son like that. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, well, I don't know exactly what I mean. I'm literally translating the idiom there, and the question is, what is that idiom? What does it mean to be at the breast of the Father? At the very least, though, what you're pointing to has to be right, that it has to be talking about this relational bond, this emotional bond between God and this unique human being. I don't think there's any question. What exactly that implies, I'm not clear, but at least that much, I think, has to be true.
Jack, in verse 3, you said, it reads, "Now this very light yet shines in the midst of darkness of human ignorance." Would that be a metaphor for just human rebelliousness?
Right. Yeah, our foolish, ignorant disregard of the truth of who we are in relationship to God and all that entails, I think.
Well, it's not just that our minds don't work, it's that we're rebellious.
Right.
Our minds don't work right. It's just that it's more of a moral connotation.
Absolutely.
Than how our minds actually work.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know that we would necessarily know that from the word alone, but from the context in which it gets used all the time, yes. Yet ultimately, our problem is the rebellion that makes us stupid, not intellectual ineptitude. That's not our issue. That's not the issue.
It's kind of what Paul's getting at in Romans 1 then about,
yes,
how God gave us over to minds that don't think right or judge right.
Exactly. Yeah.
For this wonderful new translation that you've provided for us, I noticed that it's the beta version, and
yes.
I was wondering, does it also have a list of problems with this interpretation or not?
No, there are no problems with this interpretation. But since it is the beta version, we can discover them together if you want.
When you were talking about Jesus explaining God, I wondered how, you said, if it weren't for Jesus, how would we know? How would we know about God? But in Romans, it says, from what has been made, we should know, we are without excuse because God and his attributes, divine attributes and blah, 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 should be evident. So I'm wondering how you put those two things together. Was it just hyperbole when you said, how would we know? Or
yeah, probably. Yeah, mostly hyperbole. I do think that there is, reading the goodness of God off of creation is more problematic than reading the wisdom, the power, the transcendence, the bigness of God is easy to see off of creation. His goodness is more subtle. Do I think we could know the goodness of God from the created order? Yes, I do, ultimately. I do think that. But it's a trickier exegetical exercise to do that. Jesus makes it crystal clear. Jesus leaves no ambiguity about that. And that's the sense in which I think he explains him. Not that we literally couldn't know at all apart from Jesus, but he makes clear what otherwise could be ambiguous.
A second question. Before I ask it, can you remind me, is the name Lucifer ever used in the Bible? Or is that something that has sort of come down from
interpretations? Does it come from the translation of Isaiah? Yes, okay. There's a passage in Isaiah about the king of Tyre. I think in there they have sort of transliterated or anglicized a Hebrew word, I think.
That means Lucifer?
Yeah.
Well, just recently I had opportunity to discover that the name Michael means who is like God. And Michael seems to be the good counterpart of Lucifer, who is, you know, the ultimate bad guy. And it occurred to me that as you were talking, if Lucifer is kind of a self-designation of Satan, he's claiming, means light bearer, he's claiming to be the bearer of light, whereas Michael, in total 180 degrees, says, who is like God? But when you look at the person of Michael himself, the angel, he was pretty spectacular. And it occurred to me in your metaphor of light and darkness, or you're talking about light and darkness, how it's true the universe wasn't built for me. I am not the main player in this drama. On the other hand, there must be a sense in which I'm significant if the God of the universe died for me. And my significance is properly understood, must be like Michael's significance when it's a reflected glory. Nobody would ever see me if it weren't for the light shining on me to reflect off of me. So Michael did not claim to be a source of light, but clearly he was a glorious creature, mm-hmm. and he rightly understood that his glory was just a reflection of his creator, mm-hmm. whereas apparently Lucifer is claiming to be the light himself.
Good. Yeah, thank you. One more.
Jack, would you explain again that important subtle difference? If in Christianity we practice a philosophy of living, of life, and all other religions are just that, a philosophy, a practice, how do we explain the important differentiation that Christianity is the story of the truth? How do you jump and compare that important differentiation?
Okay, yeah, good. I should have. take the way I used to look at the faith. The way I used to look at the faith is that we have in Christianity the way to live life so that my life here and now will go better. I want a marriage that works. I need to live according to biblical principles. I want to raise my children right. How do I do that? I raise them according to biblical principles. I want my business to be successful. How should I do that? I should run my business according to biblical principles. Right on down the line. And really, the sum and substance of the faith that I sort of absorbed by osmosis from the Christian culture that I was immersed in was, this is the way to live in order to have things go better. Now, seeing the faith that way, does it really make any difference whether Moses even existed, whether Abraham even existed, whether the prophets ever came to Israel and spoke, whether Israel even existed? No, not really. That was always a problem to me, sort of subconsciously, back in the botherings of my mind. It always bothered me. Why is any of that stuff relevant? Because you open the Bible and it seems to be the main thing. Abraham, Moses, Jesus. For that matter, what bothered me the most is, what difference does it make whether Jesus died on the cross? Well, I had a ready answer for that. Well, after you're done having a successful business here in this lifetime, you want everlasting life and you got to believe in Jesus to have that. It was kind of this afterthought. An important afterthought, but an afterthought. And Jesus was crucial to that afterthought. So I had the answer to that. But it always kind of bothered me. If it's just a matter of walking according to the Spirit, why can't I walk according to the Spirit with or without Jesus dying on the cross? We have a theology that says, well, God couldn't send the Spirit until Jesus died on the cross. Okay, well, why? I mean, never mind that. Why couldn't, if all God wants me to do is to live the way a human being was meant to live, and that's by operating by the power of the Spirit and on his own power, why is any of this other stuff at all relevant? Why don't you just teach me how to live by the power of the Spirit? That's what the Taoists do. They teach people how to live by the power of the Tao. Why can't I just live by the power of the Spirit and have everything be hunky-dory? Why complicate it with all these Bible stories and stuff? Well, That's where I was thinking about it wrong. This is not primarily simply simple instruction about how to live here and now. It's this big, huge explanation of a story that I fit into, that I have a role in, that I have a place in, and I don't understand who I am until I understand the big story that I have to come to terms with, that I have a role to play in. And it's understanding that that is really the wisdom that lets me know how to live. And in the process of understanding that story, then, of course, the big deal is understanding who the main player is, Jesus. Now, all of a sudden, from that point of view, Jesus is not an afterthought. Jesus is not, oh, yeah, and there's Jesus, too. Jesus is what it's all about, which is clearly what the Bible presents. But my theology didn't allow me to really make sense out of that. But this theology demands that. This theology makes perfectly good sense out of that.
That was an excellent answer. Really differentiated gave it a solid explanation of what's the difference. That really was...
I meant to actually say that in the message. Just forgot. So,
I feel the urgency to say thank you. It was a very good message.
Thank you.